Hi, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com. Welcome to Speaking of Sex. On this podcast, we offer expert advice so you can have an amazing sex life. You can submit questions for future episodes by going to PleasureMechanics.com, where you will also find a complete archive of all of our podcast episodes. We're approaching 140 episodes now. It's very exciting. And while you're there, definitely check out our erotic mastery courses. Our online multimedia courses cover everything from couples massage to foreplay mastery to erotic spanking, and you'll find them all at PleasureMechanics.com. Use the code JUSTTHETIP for 20% off the course of your choice. And today's episode features a very amazing interview with Ogi Ogas, one of the authors of A Billion Wicked Thoughts. And you can get this entire book absolutely free as an audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/pleasure. That's audibletrial.com/pleasure. And our friends at Audible will hook you up with an absolutely free membership and a free book. And you can choose A Billion Wicked Thoughts or any of the other amazing sex and erotica books they've got for you. Audiobooks are an awesome way to consume sex information. As you know from this podcast, there's something really intimate about listening to a book. So when you're talking about intimate issues, audiobooks can't be beat in my mind. You can even listen to erotica on your way to work. So we love audiobooks, and you can get your first audiobook free by going to audibletrial.com/pleasure. Let them hook you up. On today's episode, we have the pleasure of speaking with Ogi Ogas, co-author of A Billion Wicked Thoughts. Ogi received his PhD in computational neuroscience from Boston University, where he designed mathematical models of learning, memory, and vision. Ogi was also a Department of Homeland Security fellow and conducted biodefense research at MIT Lincoln Laboratory. So not our usual guest by far. But Ogi brought all of his skills to investigating one of the biggest mysteries in human history. What exactly arouses men and women? What are our true desires, unfiltered by the social forces of shame and secrecy? Together with his co-author Sai Gadam, Dr. Ogi Ogas analyzed a billion web searches, a million websites, a million erotic videos, a million erotic stories, millions of personal ads, tens of thousands of digitized romance novels, and much more. The results? Stunning data on the nature of desire and fantasy gathered together in the amazing book, A Billion Wicked Thoughts. Ogi, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Chris.
Let's start right at the beginning. What is a computational neuroscientist, and how did you apply this skill to researching sexuality? How'd you make that leap?
So computational neuroscientists study the brain, but they study the brain from a very particular perspective, as if the brain is software running in hardware. And computational neuroscientists try to decode the software of the brain. So for example, vision, which is something that very commonly studied in computational neuroscience, try to figure out the visual software, how the brain processes faces or colors or shapes. And most people in the field of computational neuroscience look at the higher functions of the brain, like vision, language, planning, but nobody in our field, when we started our research, had ever applied these methods and this approach to the brain to analyze the sexual brain. Nobody had ever tried to figure out the software of the sexual brain before. And so that's what initially excited us to try this out. We thought, here's these great tools, this great approach to understanding the brain that had been proven out in many parts of the brain, but had never been used to take a look at sexuality. So we thought maybe there'd be some low-hanging fruit that we could find if we just applied these methodologies to understanding the sexual brain.
And this correlated with a moment in technology where we had this body of data that you could mine for some insights. Can you offer us a summary of the research you used to approach A Billion Wicked Thoughts?
Sure. So in our field of computational neuroscience, to model the brain effectively, you need a lot of data. You need very rich data. And as you pointed out, when we started our research, we're at a unique point in history where for the first time we had huge amounts of data on sexual behavior through the internet. So for our research, we gathered as much data as we could get our hands on. So we looked at billions of searches. We looked at more than 500,000 individual search histories. We looked at more than a million erotic stories, millions of erotic imageries and videos and how they were rated. We looked at the top million websites in the world and figured out which of those top million websites were erotic websites, and then analyzed the traffic and the popularity of these different erotic websites. We analyzed more than 10,000 romance novels. We looked at credit card purchases of erotic content, downloads of erotic content, a few private erotic websites shared their internal data with us. So we really grabbed a whole bunch of really wide range of different kinds of data and analyzed it. And when we started our research, we were the first ones to have ever tried that.
And so when you say a billion wicked thoughts, you're not over-exaggerating that number. You've really looked at so many numbers. And I'm imagining you're doing this with the assistance of software. Can you geek out for a second on exactly what it means to look at so much data? Are you looking for patterns? You're looking for specific word choices? How does that work?
So one of the most central kinds of data that we used was trying to figure out the category or class of a sexual interest. For example, how many searches there were for, here's an easy one, breasts. So we had to figure out, in this case, every possible synonym that's used for breast. And there's quite a few. And then we had to basically keep refining these text analyzers to make sure that we were pulling, for example, searches for actual breasts related to sexuality, but not for, say, breast cancer. So a lot of our tech work was just on refining these filters. And we've spent a lot of time on that. In fact, after the book came out, we went even further. We used some new techniques too. So we have even better analysis of our data now than we did when we published the book.
Maybe an update is coming.
Yes, we're going to try to push something out pretty soon, actually.
Right, because I imagine, so you gathered this data, and even in the 5 years since then, I imagine usage patterns have changed and more women are using the internet to search for sexually explicit things. So we'll be curious what you find there. But can you talk about what you found in the differences of how men and women were using the internet to search for their desires at the time of your research?
Certainly, and we always say that the two biggest findings, the biggest overall findings from our research are that we found that men and women's tastes are probably even more different than we would have expected. I think we all know that there's, you know, probably we all expect there's going to be some differences between what men do and women do, but when you really look at online behaviors, it's just dramatically different. And a complement to that, which I'll hopefully talk about later, is gay sexual activity is virtually identical to straight sexual activity. So gay men and straight men behave virtually identically in every way when it comes to sexual behavior online. And straight women and lesbian women also extremely similar. Mm. So those are sort of like the two biggest findings. So talking about men and women's differences, at the highest level, it can be summed up. For men, online sexuality is a solitary enterprise. And it's very much driven towards very, very specific sexual interests. So men tend to, when they do online activities, they're by themselves and they don't share that activity with anyone else. And they typically search for the same specific thing over and over and over again. For women, erotic behavior is very social. If you look at erotic content for women, it's very oriented towards communities and discussion. It's much more interactive. And in addition, women's interest in sexual content is much more diverse and open-ended. You don't find women searching for one specific thing over and over again. They tend to search for broad themes. They're much more likely to change the kind of thing that they're searching for. They're much more interested in characters, personality, relationships, much more nuanced, open-ended things than with men. So one of the consequences of this is that it's much, much easier from a science point of view to analyze and do research on men's sexual interests, because men's sexual behavior is so well defined, it's very, very easy to parse with software. Women's sexual behavior is, because it's so much more nuanced and complicated, it's not as easy to break it down and summarize it as it is for men's sexual interests. So just from a methodological point of view, women are much harder to study, even online, than men are.
Let's talk about that specificity, because with the proliferation of internet porn, we can get more and more specific. So we can look at blonde cheerleaders wearing glasses, smoking a pipe, and we can find an entire site dedicated to that. How does that specificity work within the software of the brain? Is this affecting men's interest in their real lives? Can you talk a little bit about that specificity and what that means for men's sexuality?
Sure. So just to take a step back to kind of put some biological context around that, it's clear that the male sexual brain is designed to, well, even higher than this, men's sexual brain is designed to find an appealing, attractive, useful female partner. And the female sexual brain is designed for the same thing, except to find a useful, attractive, appealing male partner. And what makes a good male partner is very different than what makes a good female partner. So from a biological point of view, and here we're just talking purely about reproduction and from an evolutionary perspective, what makes a good female partner is health and fertility. So any sign or indication that a woman is healthy and fertile, the male sexual brain is designed from a very, very general point of view to focus in on that. And what makes a woman healthy and fertile, it turns out, is a relatively narrow set of cues, mostly physical cues. If a woman's younger, she's more likely to be healthy and fertile. And if she has certain physical characteristics of her weight, of her symmetry, things like that, again, more likely to be healthy and fertile. So as a result of this, the male sexual brain is designed at a very early age to imprint upon a narrow range of physical, tactile cues and olfactory cues that presumably, in most cases, are going to be associated with a healthy, fertile woman. So that's why you find men focusing so much on visual features. For example, breasts. Every culture in the world, men are very interested in looking at breasts and buttocks, things like that. Men develop this interest very early, and they fixate on it. And it makes sense from a biological point of view, because these things are consistent indicators. If a breast is an indicator of health and fertility now, no matter what culture or era or time you go to, it's still going to be an accurate indicator. Very different for what makes a good male partner. For a woman, from a purely biological point of view, a male partner should be someone who's strong, who's able to protect her and protect the children. He should care about her, so he should have some emotional commitment. He should care about kids. If a man brutalizes kids, obviously that's not going to make a good partner. And he should have social status, again, because social status would make it more likely that he'll be able to take care of his family. And what makes a man have these qualities varies from culture to culture. You know, some cultures, a doctor might be a high-status individual. In other cultures, he may not be. A software programmer, some cultures, is an attractive partner, and some cultures not. You know, 1,000 years ago, what made an attractive partner is very different. An attractive male partner is very different than what makes an attractive male partner today. So the female sexual brain is designed to be more flexible and adaptive and much more sophisticated, ultimately, in terms of evaluating a wide range of cues that indicate whether a man is social status, whether he has the emotional equipment to take care of her. It takes a lot more analysis. So that's why you find with men, just very narrow physical visual cues are all it takes. But for women, you find much more nuanced, complicated cues. And this is absolutely reflected in online sexual behaviors and online sexual taste.
Interesting. I hear all of that, and yet a lot of your data looks at non-evolutionary cues that might be triggering arousal, like older women. Can you speak a little bit to that, of the gap between what evolutionary biology might talk about and what we're acculturated now to find arousing?
Absolutely. Great point. And what we find is that we no longer live in an environment that's anything like what we evolved in. We live in a highly technological environment, highly digitized environment, and so very different civilized culture now. So the kinds of sexual stimuli we're all exposed to is very, very different. And as a result, we don't find the kind of very narrow sexual taste that maybe evolutionary psychologists would predict. And you gave two great examples. Two big surprises in our data was the popularity of older women and the popularity of overweight women. These were far more popular all around the world than anybody expected, especially evolutionary people. Now, we'd still say, though, it is interesting that in terms of what men focus on, two broad categories that they focus on are age and weight. So age is the number one category. Now, it's not just evolutionary psychologists would predict that men are focused on youth, and youth is indeed the most popular age. But we found that there's a very, very strong interest in older women, women in their 40s, even in their 50s, all around the world. And a big surprise, there is significant interest even in women in their 60s. And this is a genuine sexual interest. When we were first sharing this data, people thought, oh, maybe this is just curiosity, looking at a kind of erotica that's commonly called granny porn. People thought, oh, this is just curiosity. It's for fun. It's not really a genuine sexual interest. But if you look at the data and the websites and the content and the communities, it's very clearly an authentic sexual interest, as genuine as an interest in teenage women, for example. So that's certainly a surprise from an evolutionary point of view. But what we think it suggests is the male brain still focused on age. In terms of how men search for material, age is always very prominent. So whether it's searching for teens or searching for what are called MILFs, most people probably know what a MILF is these days, a mother I like to fornicate with, or grannies, age is one of the number one ways that men just classify what they're looking for. The other big one is weight, is mass. So also clearly a visual cue and a physical cue. So clearly men are thinking about weight. But certainly it was a surprise. We found that men are three times as likely, or there's three times as many searches for fat women, putting fat in quotes there, than for skinny women, putting skinny in quotes. That was certainly a big surprise. In every culture we looked at, there is a very strong interest in overweight women. So just to be clear, the strongest interest is in healthy weight women. And just to give some specificity there, healthy weight is defined by the Center for Disease Control. Numbers are certainly disputed about whether that's truly healthy or not. But if just using that as a yardstick, men are most interested in healthy weight women. But given the choice between a woman with a few pounds extra versus a few pounds less, a majority of men are going to prefer a woman with a few pounds more. So that was a surprise. But that one makes a little more sense. That one, evolutionary psychologists probably wouldn't have as hard a time with. They'd point out that for most of our evolutionary history, having more weight would increase the likelihood of you being healthy and fertile. Skinny women can be an indication that you're not as healthy, not getting as much nutrition. And also, obviously, at the extreme case, very skinny women stop ovulating as well, so it would not make them fertile. So that one makes a little more sense. But certainly, culturally speaking, there's a general cultural belief that men prefer skinny women. But it's a bit ironic where you find the most skinny women the most prominent is on fashion magazines aimed at women. But when you look at pornography aimed at men, you're far more likely to find heavy, overweight women.
Right. So this men looking at curvy girls online is this classic example of the gap between what we admit publicly, socially, what is permissible versus our desires and our interests and our fantasies that we seek out even under the semi-anonymity of online searches. We all have this sense that we might be being watched, but at the same time, there is a sense of privacy there that allows more of our desires to come forward. What were some of the other surprising desires that you saw in these billions of data points?
So there's more surprises for male sexual interest. There's a few for women, so let me talk about a few other ones for men first. Perhaps one of the biggest is a kind of pornography commonly called shemale porn. And let me immediately say that I recognize shemale. The term shemale is considered derogatory for good reason. But it is used by the fans of this particular kind of erotica to describe erotica generally consists of models or cartoons with female bodies and a penis, often a large penis. And why this is not exactly transsexual porn is because a lot of the erotica is animation or artistic or cartoons where it's clearly drawn to be impossible figures. You know, it's voluptuous 16-year-old girls, very curvy, with impossibly large penises. And also as part of this genre is female models with strap-on penises. So the audience for this content is heterosexual males primarily, not gay men. When we first did this research, you know, everyone was convinced that the biggest audience for this pornography was gay men. Gay men are rarely interested in this. Typically, they're not interested in it at all. It's straight men. And that was certainly a big surprise because this doesn't make sense either from an evolutionary point of view. Certainly, evolutionary psychologists can't account for this, and they were very resistant to our findings when we were first reporting them. They just didn't believe them. But it also doesn't fit a cultural explanation because certainly our culture is not reinforcing the idea that straight men should be interested in this kind of erotic content. So this is certainly one of the biggest surprises. And we found a very strong interest. This is very popular, again, in every culture in the world, but including here in the United States. And that was a puzzle. That was something that we spent a lot of time trying to understand. I mean, you can talk about it later. So that was certainly a big surprise. Also, some atypical sexual interests that people thought were rare, which actually turned out to not be so rare, was an interest in incest content, bestiality. Those are certainly things that make people uncomfortable. As I already mentioned, older women, granny porn also has a significant amount of interest. So those are some of the things that, and certainly one of the very, very biggest surprises was the interest among heterosexual men in looking at penises. Searches for penises, websites devoted to penises, large penises in particular, extremely common. One of the top 10 interests among men of all kinds, gay and straight, all around the world. So that was certainly a big surprise, just the number of men that are actively searching for large penises and looking at that content.
Okay, I want to dig in there a little bit because we get a lot of emails from guys who are very distraught about their arousal when they see penises in porn or what turns into fantasies about touching penises when they fully identify as heterosexual. What would you tell these guys?
So the interest in penises, there's many different ways to look at it. There's many different kinds of arousal that are generated from this. So the primary one that I think covers most heterosexual men is looking at a large penis that's near a female face or a woman. If you look at the majority of large penis porn, usually called big dick porn, it consists of a man with a large penis, but you never find the penis apart from a woman looking at it or reacting to it or talking about it. So it's sort of the interaction of these elements. The penis is certainly very prominent, but there's always a woman commenting on it or talking about it or reacting to it or certainly touching it or pleasuring it. And it seems to be this combination of the penis and the emotion of the woman that most heterosexual men find arousing. So that's the most common case. Certainly, many heterosexual men, as you pointed out, do fantasize about touching it or interacting with it. You certainly find that too. Not as common as just the interaction of the woman's reaction with the penis, but that's certainly out there too. Mm. And the first thing to say is, look, these are very common. So if you're feeling this yourself, there's nothing unusual about you. You know, we can't control these things. These are deep-rooted things that are just simply part of the sexual brain. So there's no indication that this indicates some kind of suppressed homosexuality. Perhaps it does. It depends on the individual, of course. It's hard to have generalities about this, but what we can say with great confidence is this is absolutely widespread, so common and widespread that we could call it natural. I'm always hesitant to use the word normal, but certainly natural would apply.
Hmm. And you talk also about the cuckolding fetish and gangbangs, and that seeing these scenarios can spike testosterone and create what you call the sperm competition.
Yeah, so that's another aspect to this. So why are men so interested in looking at penises? You know, this is when we first turned this up, this was seemed to be a baffling question because, again, it seems to violate biology. But actually, it turns out there is a reasonable biological explanation. The penis seems to be what you called a sperm competition cue. So this is very well studied phenomenon in evolution across all species. And a sperm competition cue is any cue that causes a male of any species to become more aroused, to generate more sperm, to become more female seeking in order to compete with another male. So a very typical example of an evolutionary adaptation that's as a result of a sperm competition cue is among chimpanzees. Chimpanzees have very large testicles, the largest testicle-to-body proportion of any of the primates. And the reason why is because chimpanzees are far more promiscuous than other primates, including humans. And you also often find multiple males having sex with the same female over a short period of time. So in order to compete with other males, sperm, chimpanzees have developed large testicles, which enables them to ejaculate with greater force and greater amount, which tends to have a greater chance of pushing out other male sperm. In humans, the human male has a physical sperm competition adaptation. It's the shape of the penis. The human penis is shaped like a shovel, and it's designed to literally shovel out other male sperm. This is actually seems to be the reason why after men ejaculate, they become soft and flaccid. If men are wondering why that is, it's so that you don't inadvertently shovel out your own sperm using your shovel-shaped penis. So in addition to these physical adaptations, there's psychological adaptations. And so the penis among all primates, monkeys, gorillas, chimpanzees, is a very prominent social tool. It's used to indicate aggression, to mark territory, to indicate sexual interests. And among all other primates, the males are constantly monitoring other males' penises for signs of both aggression and sexual interest. And so it does seem clear that in other species, other primate species, the visual, you know, a visual erection is a sperm competition cue that causes males to become aroused or more likely to seek out females. And so there's every reason to imagine that this some vestigial form of this, or even not so vestigial form of this, is within the human male brain, that when you see other males erect penises, it's more likely to make you become aroused in order to successfully compete with the other male. So that certainly seems like a reasonable hypothesis given the way other primates behave. And so that might be one reason why even heterosexual men are just so interested in looking at penises. They're just following other primates. And that's often,
I wonder, you know, we're social sexual beings at our roots. And so I sometimes wonder if pornography fills that void now that sexuality has become so private, of just the pure arousal of seeing other primates in action.
Oh, absolutely. I think so. I mean, we've completely walled off sexuality from our personal lives. And so I absolutely think that pornography, I mean, I think for most of our lives, we are much closer to sexuality. Much, you know, you hear in the parents, you know, in the same hut or walking by, you know, who's having sex with whom. It's never very far away in Aboriginal peoples, for example. And here it's just so closed off that I think it's certainly fulfilling. We all have a deep desire to learn. I think that's part of it, is we're designed to learn about sexual behavior, about others' sexual proclivities, about other sexual availability. And since it's all so walled off now, that we take to pornography to make up for it.
So that was part one of our interview with Dr. Ogi Ogis. Next week, on Wednesday, as our Just the Tip episode, we will share part two, where Dr. Ogi Ogis talks about submission and dominance and how prevalent they are in human sexuality. Here is a sneak peek.
The most important finding from all of our research is that fact that domination and submission is absolutely fundamental to everyone's sexual identity. Domination and submission themes are the only sexual interest that everyone has in common.
So don't miss part two of our interview with Dr. Ogi Ogis. And remember, you can get A Billion Wicked Thoughts absolutely free by going to audibletrial.com/pleasure. That's audibletrial.com/pleasure. And we'll have that link for you on the show notes page over at pleasuremechanics.com. I'm Chris from Pleasure Mechanics, wishing you a lifetime of pleasure. We'll see you next week for the conclusion, where we get a little feisty with Dr. Ogi Ogis. Cheers.